The headlines: Iran's president meets students and academics in Peking University in the Chinese capital on the second day of his state visit to Beijing. The death toll from earthquakes in Turkey and Syria passes 41,000 as the UN initiates its largest ever deployment of emergency medical teams to help some 26 million people in need. And Russia says that its forces have made gains in Luhansk, while Ukraine calls on its Western allies to speed up the pace of military aid. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, has paid a visit to Peking University in the Chinese capital, Beijing, on the second day of his official tour to the country. During his visit to the university, Raisi held a meeting with scholars and university professors. The Iranian president was also awarded an honorary doctorate degree by the university's authorities. Raisi's visit came a day after he held high-level meetings with Chinese officials, including President Xi Jinping. Officials from both sides also signed 20 cooperation documents.
Ebrahim Raisi is in Beijing for a three-day state visit. That's the first such trip by an Iranian president to China in 20 years. Upon his arrival, he was welcomed by his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping. During their meeting, the two presidents sounded determined to strengthen the two countries' partnership, both vowing to work toward implementation of the 25-year Strategic Cooperation Pact, whatever international conditions be.
We believe that implementing the 25-year cooperation agreement and realizing what agreed between the two countries' officials today to develop bilateral ties can promote regional and global peace and stability. Certainly, relations between Iran and China will not be affected by international developments, since we're determined to develop ties with China in any circumstances.
China will continue to be committed to consolidating and deepening relations with Iran. I'm willing to work with President Raisi to enhance strategic communication and promote the steady and sustained growth of the comprehensive strategic partnership between the two countries.
Of course, the two presidents had much more to say. Raisi said there is still much more for expanding economic and trade collaboration between the two sides, adding that such collaboration would contribute to peace and stability across the globe. On the other side, Xi hailed China's growing solidarity with Tehran, saying the two countries have supported each other in the face of complex global challenges. He added that China supports Iran's efforts to safeguard its national sovereignty and independence and counter hegemony and unilateralism. Political analyst Christopher Hilali says further deepening of Iran-China ties will greatly strengthen the developments of a multipolar world.
The deepening of ties further strengthens the development of a multipolar world. Against what both the Chinese and the Iranians said was the ongoing hegemony and unilateralism of Western domination, specifically led by the United States.
Iranian academic Said Mohammad Marandi, who is accompanying the Iranian delegation in Beijing, says the West antagonistic attitude has accelerated convergence among Asian nations.
Asia alone, through this natural convergence, which is being pushed forward even faster, largely due to the fact that the United States and the Europeans are constantly antagonizing governments and sanctioning governments, whether it's Russia, whether it's Iran, and increasingly China, and also by constantly trying to prevent India from establishing greater ties with these Asian powers, the United States and Europeans are pushing these countries towards greater convergence at a faster pace.
Tehran-Beijing cooperation has been only growing over the past couple of years. China has now become Iran's largest trading partner, with figures showing volume of trade between the two rose by over 40% in the previous Iranian calendar year, which ended on March the 20th. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. Iran is also eager to contribute to China's mega project, the Belt and Road Initiative. China and Iran now appear set to take their partnership to the next level for prosperity of their nations.
Also, Palestinians have held a funeral procession for a teenage boy killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Seventeen-year-old Mahmoud Majid succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli raid on the Al-Fara refugee camp near Nablus. The incident came a day after a 22-year-old Palestinian was killed by Israeli troopers in the same city. The regime has been conducting raids across the occupied territories almost on a daily basis. The crackdown has left nearly 50 Palestinians dead since the turn of the year. And Israel's far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, says he wants to see more Jewish settlements constructed across the occupied territories. Ben-Gvir said building new settlements is, quote, Israel's mission and doctrine. He said 9 settlements are not enough, and the regime wants much more. The minister said Europeans and Americans should, quote, stop worrying. Foreign ministers from Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and the United States have said they are, quote, deeply troubled by Israel's settlement expansion plan. The regime has already authorized new settlement outposts and pledged to construct new settler units in the West Bank. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has called for an end to the settlement expansion. All the settlements are illegal under international law and the Geneva Conventions. Palestinian resistance factions have held a conference in Gaza to drum up support for Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank amid the increasing Israeli aggression and the use of lethal force against Palestinians. Our correspondent Asher Shannon has more from Gaza.
Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures, backed by regime forces, have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Actually, Al-Quds is not just a word. It's something apart from our heart. So this conference asking and telling the world that this Israeli action against Al-Quds and West Bank must be stopped.
Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. They also vowed to use all forms of resistance to liberate Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We believe that the Israeli government, under the leading of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, going to raising up the aggressive against our people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza also, maybe in other outside countries also. So we are going to resent the occupation by all kind of resistance.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank while turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Palestinians say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Rescuers in quake-hit Turkish city of Adıyaman have pulled a 77-year-old woman alive from the rubble where she had been trapped for an astounding 212 hours. The death toll from the 7.8 magnitude earthquake and a powerful aftershock that jolted Turkey and Syria last week has crossed 41,000. The figure is expected to rise as search and rescue operations are still ongoing. On Tuesday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said the earthquakes were as big as atomic bombs. He also vowed to press on with rescue and recovery efforts until the last person is found from the wreckage of collapsed buildings. The World Health Organization has also described the devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria as the worst natural disaster in a century.
we are witnessing the worst natural disaster in the WHO European region for a century, and we are still learning about its magnitude. Its true cost is not known yet. Recovering and healing will take time and a phenomenal effort.
In a virtual press conference from London, the WHO director for the European region said the UN Health Agency has initiated its largest ever deployment of emergency medical teams to help some 26 million people in need of humanitarian aid. The UN has called for international funding to help people in Syria, which has already been devastated by years of foreign-backed militancy and Western sanctions. Almost $400 million in aid appealed by the UN would provide much-needed life-saving relief, including shelter, healthcare, and food for Syrians for about 3 months.
Years of war in Syria has destabilized the region, which is still suffering from an ongoing humanitarian emergency. Millions are displaced within Syria or have fled to Turkey, which is contending with high inflation and a deepening economic crisis. The earthquake unleashed widespread damage and destruction in some of the most at-risk areas in the region. A magnitude 7.8 earthquake struck near Nurdaghi in southern Turkey around 4:17 a.m. local time on February 6th. A magnitude 7.5 earthquake followed around later that afternoon around 1 p.m. local time, along with scores of powerful aftershocks. Thousands are injured and thousands more remain trapped in the rubble, and the chance of finding survivors gets narrower and narrower. Search and recovery operations continue with assistance from teams around the world, but freezing weather is hampering rescue efforts and making it even more difficult to access possible survivors. This catastrophe hit an already fragile region, which has been marred by decades of war in Syria and economic, humanitarian, and public health crises. Turkey is facing a profound economic crisis, with a collapsing currency and extraordinary inflation that hit around 80% last year, the highest in about 25 years. The quake-hit part of Turkey also hosts a large population of Syrian refugees. The economic crisis in Turkey has helped fuel a backlash against the approximately 3.6 million Syrian refugees in the country, who are already facing poverty, discrimination, an increase in violent attacks, and the risk of deportation. More than 2 million people in northwestern Syria are also at risk of a deadly cholera outbreak. The outbreak began in northeastern Syria, attributed to contaminated water from the Euphrates River, which people were relying on in part because of the water infrastructure destroyed by years of fighting. About 47% of people in Syria rely on unsafe drinking water, a potentially even bigger risk after the massive infrastructure damaged by the earthquake. In northwest Syria, in particular, this outbreak was straining an already stretched and under-resourced health system, which will now also need to find ways to treat those injured in the earthquake. The devastation extends beyond northwest Syria, as the country as a whole has been overwhelmed by years of war and destruction. International sanctions against Syria are also deepening the economic crisis Syrians face. The country faces record and widespread poverty and food shortages. About 90% of Syrians live below the poverty line, and nearly 75% struggle to meet their most basic needs. And across the region, the crisis is still acute, as agencies and officials rush to find survivors in the rubbles and temperatures drop. The earthquake compounds catastrophe upon catastrophe in Syria and Turkey. It is likely to exacerbate those that already exist while creating new, unpredictable ones.
Moving now to Ukraine, where Russia says its troops have made further advances in the eastern Luhansk region. The defense ministry said troops have broken through the front line in Luhansk, forcing Ukrainian troops to randomly retreat to a distance of up to 3 kilometers. The ministry did not specify the exact location of the offensive. Ukraine's military has also reported increasingly heavy Russian attacks along the front line, but says the Russians have not yet made any advances. The Ukrainian army chief says the city of Bakhmut and near towns in Donetsk have also been shelled, but Kiev remains in full control of the area. Meanwhile, Ukraine's president has described the situation in Donetsk and Luhansk as very difficult. Volodymyr Zelensky has called for more Western military support in the shortest time possible.
The battles are literally for every foot of the Ukrainian land. That is why speed is of the essence. Speed in everything, adopting decisions, carrying out decisions, shipping supplies and training.
Zelensky's call comes as NATO defense ministers are meeting in the Belgian capital, Brussels, for the second day to discuss the war in Ukraine. On Tuesday, they pledged unflagging military support for Kiev. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the alliance will be sending more heavy weapons to Ukraine, but has not yet reached a consensus on war planes. The German defense minister has been quoted as saying that sending fighter jets to Ukraine is not a focus at the moment. Russia has repeatedly condemned the West for providing Kiev with weapons, saying the move only prolongs the war. Commission investigating abuse in Portugal's Catholic Church says over 100 priests suspected of child sexual abuse remain active in church roles. The commission said it was preparing a list of the accused priests who were still working to send to the church and the public prosecutor's office. Head of the bishop's conference says as long as it's proven the priest is an abuser, he cannot hold positions within the ministry. The church, however, says it will not conduct a, quote, witch hunt against its members. On Monday, the commission said it has documented abuse of nearly 5,000 children over the past 7 decades. The abuse took place almost anywhere possible, including at Catholic schools, churches, priests' homes, and confessionals. The majority of cases happen with children aged between 10 and 14. Argentina says its inflation rate is almost 100%, with workers' budgets straining as costs outstrip salaries. The inflation rate is the highest since hyperinflation in the 1990s. The South American country also saw monthly inflation speed up to 6% in January. Rampant inflation has slammed the economy, forcing the central bank to raise interest rates to 75%. This has hit the popularity of the center-left government of President Alberto Fernandez hard ahead of general elections in October. The conservative opposition now leads in the polls as many blame poor economic management and money printing by the government. Elsewhere, the United Nations is sounding the alarm over the health and nutrition crises in Afghanistan. The World Health Organization says tens of thousands of Afghan children and women will suffer from acute malnutrition in 2023. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Turkish authorities have arrested contractors for negligence over buildings flattened by recent earthquakes. Turkey's justice minister has vowed to take action against negligence and flaws after deadly earthquakes flattened more than 6,000 buildings in southeast of the country. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Turkey's TRT World has covered this story and tells us more. Turkish authorities have begun to arrest contractors over buildings that collapsed after two deadly earthquakes jolted southeastern Turkey and northern Syria. The role of 131 suspects relating to the buildings collapsed in the earthquake has been determined, the Turkish Vice President Fuat Oktay said late on Saturday. He said one of them has been arrested and detention orders have been announced for 113 others. Earlier, police arrested Hasan Alpargun in the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus after some buildings made by his construction company collapsed in the southern Adana province, according to security forces. Prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for Alpargun on suspicion of reckless manslaughter and other charges. Contractor Ibrahim Mustafa Unkurlu was arrested in Istanbul after technical examination of the wreckage of an apartment building in the Gaziantep province found neglect. Istanbul police arrested another contractor, Mehmet Ertan Akay, after his building collapsed during the earthquake in Gaziantep. Prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for Akay on charges of reckless manslaughter and building code violations. Mehmet Yashar Kurşgun, the contractor of a large residential building in the hard-hit Hatay province, was also taken into custody. Security forces arrested Kurşgun in Istanbul airport on his way to Montenegro while attempting to leave the country. Kurşgun claimed that he did not know why the building collapsed and that his flight to Montenegro had nothing to do with the collapsed building. Turkey's Justice Minister, Bagir Bozdag, on Wednesday vowed to take action against negligence and flaws after the deadly earthquakes, underlining that the priority now is to save people who are trapped under the rubble. Bozdag pledged, "After that, the judicial process will follow and all those who had negligence and fault will be held accountable." At least 24,617 people have died and more than 80,000 others have been injured in two strong earthquakes that jolted southeastern Turkey on Monday last week. The magnitude 7.8 and 7.6 earthquakes centered on the Kahramanmaraş province affected more than 13 million people across 10 provinces. The provinces include Hatay, Malatya, Gaziantep, Adana, Adıyaman, Diyarbakır, Kilis, Osmaniye, and Sandıyorfa. The Financial Times has also covered this story and tells us more. Turkish authorities have launched a crackdown on developers connected to buildings that were toppled this week's devastating earthquake. The Justice Ministry has authorized almost 150 local prosecutors' offices to set up earthquake investigation units to probe contractors, surveyors, and other experts with links to destroyed buildings and ensure that they do not flee the country or destroy evidence. Turkey's Anadolu news agency reported late on Saturday. In an indication that these legal processes are already underway, a contractor for a building of luxury flats in the hard-hit Hatay province in Turkey's south was detained on Friday at Istanbul airport on his way to Montenegro, according to the Anadolu news agency. Prosecutors in Istanbul ordered the arrest after finding his flight plans, the agency said. Turkish politicians vowed to investigate poor construction quality in the aftermath of the earthquake, which killed more than 24,000 people in Turkey and thousands more in neighboring Syria. Turkey's Justice Minister, Bagir Bozdag, said earlier this week that all those who had negligence and fault will be held accountable. On Saturday, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan pledged to erect hundreds of thousands of seismically safe buildings within a year in a massive reconstruction effort. "We will not leave any of our citizens dead or alive under the rubble," he said. "Then we will quickly begin removing debris and rebuilding activities. We are making plans to build hundreds of thousands of houses, of buildings and infrastructure, or rather to establish anew our cities that were destroyed in the earthquake," Erdogan said. "God willing, we will complete the reconstruction and restoration work within a year. Around 14,000 rescuers are staging a last-ditch effort to find survivors almost a week after the earthquake, but the situation in some areas of the country is becoming fraught. Two groups of German rescuers were on Saturday forced to suspend their operations in Hatay province over security concerns, with one citing apparent shots heard in the area. Some experts have urged the government not to quickly clear the rubble in order to collect evidence against property developers and contractors. Civil engineers have said many construction projects in Turkey's southeast were undertaken with insufficient protections against ground shaking in a region that is known to be vulnerable to earthquakes. The construction industry accounts for around 5% of Turkey's economy. Meanwhile, all Turkish universities will move to online classes for the rest of the academic year so that their dormitories can be used as emergency housing for those who have lost their homes in the earthquakes. On Friday, President Erdogan conceded that the rescue had not moved sufficiently swiftly because of the sprawling area that was affected, bad weather, and rescuers and their families also being hit by the earthquake, which was the worst natural disaster in Turkey in almost a century. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. Turkish authorities have begun to arrest contractors over buildings that collapsed after deadly major earthquakes jolted southeastern Turkey. Police arrested Hasan Alparjun in the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus after some buildings made by his construction company collapsed in the southern Adana province. Prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for Hasan Alparjun on suspicion of reckless manslaughter and other charges. Contractor Ibrahim Mustafa Unkurlu was arrested in Istanbul after technical examination of the wreckage of an apartment building in the Gaziantep province found neglect. Istanbul police arrested another contractor, Mehmet Ertan Akay, after his building collapsed during the earthquake in Gaziantep. Prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for Mehmet Ertan Akay on charges of reckless manslaughter and building code violations.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
February 14 marks the anniversary of the Bahraini Revolution. This was one of the first revolutions of the Persian Gulf Arab countries, which is still evolving until today. From the harsh crackdowns to kangaroo courts to torture and mass arrests, the regime has crushed any form of opposition. So why does the revolution continue? And why doesn't it lead to the removal of the ruling Al-Khalifa regime? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the Bahraini Revolution and see whether the opposition has any chance of taking this revolution to the next level. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Gina Rabai joins us. She's a researcher from the Bahrain Forum for Human Rights, who joins us from Beirut. Also joining us is Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from Bristol.
Welcome to you both. Gina Rabai, let me first start with you and ask you if you recall the day, February 14th, we saw protests have erupted in Bahrain, which had erupted before, but not in the scale that it did back then. Of course, this is going back a number of years now, 2011. And it was one of the first to actually break out in the Arab world at that point. Why do you think it came about in the way that they did, in the numbers that they did back then? And of course, you know, they obviously felt not only were they marginalized, but they weren't part of the political system.
The beginning of the Bahrain revolution was part of what was called then the Arab Spring. But the people of Bahrain distinguished themselves from other peoples of the Arab Spring in that they did not demand the overthrow of the regime, but rather demanded reforms and demanded civil, political, and welfare rights, because that is what they lacked. The opposition leadership called for dialogue with the authority in order to reach a consensus that satisfies all. So the presence of the Al Khalifa dynasty in power was not under threat, but rather it was actually a golden opportunity for the Al Khalifa dynasty to gain popular legitimacy, even though they are an unelected dictatorial authority. However, they faced the demands with peaceful. They faced the peaceful demands and demonstrations with repression and killing, and by summoning the Peninsula Shield forces from Saudi Arabia to support the Bahraini authorities by committing massacres against the peaceful protesters. Today, the revolution continues. The people still lack what they didn't get, and actually, their demands are even more. They're now demanding the unconditional and immediate release of prisoners of conscience. Mm-hmm. The people insist on their demands because they realize that by retreating or submitting, the situation will not return to the way it was before the start of the revolution on February 14, 2011, but it will become worse, and the Al Khalifa behavior will become more vengeful and vengeful and brutal, because they clearly express grudges towards everyone who objects to their policies.
Right.
The people of Bahrain express their will to continue through their protests and that they are ready to make more sacrifices until their goals are achieved. Okay. Some of these protests are held on a daily basis. We, as human rights organizations, we monitor them daily, and they're still going on.
Okay. Well, that's what we're trying to figure out here, Tony Gosling, in terms of the way that the Al Khalifa regime has dealt with the not just the protests, but the Bahrainis, from that point until now, because we're looking at, for example, how they still banned the media, doesn't operate there since 2017, unless it's in one form or another that's for any particular, for example, event, like the, the racing event, it's the F-15, I forget what it's called, or if you have, for example, opposition that have been dissolved. I mean, it just makes it look like they have something to hide. They don't want any of this opposition to leak out. They've arrested, prosecuted, they've harassed, obviously, the human rights defenders, journalists, et cetera. What is the deal with them? Why are they trying so hard? It's been so long. If they put all that time into doing something about it, perhaps at this point something might have come out of it.
Well, look, you're quite right. Say they've got something to hide, but they're not the only Gulf state with something to hide. A lot of these countries are now normalizing relationships with Israel, if you can believe that, even though they're majority Arab countries. You know, what is going on? Something completely surreal, almost absurd. Obviously, it's not absurd for those, and I'm sorry to disappoint you, but there was no revolution. Obviously, there is a movement against the government for the repressive authoritarian regime. Human Rights Watch is talking about their human rights record as dismal. Torture is normal. Demonstrators, human rights demonstrators, are executed in Bahrain. And, of course, it was part of the 2011 Arab Spring. This is the same in many, many countries where this Arab Spring took place. In fact, in Egypt, probably one of the worst, was where the Muslim Brotherhood came to power. And what happened? The Americans intervened with the U.S., basically the Pentagon and the U.S. deep state intervened there and then just toppled the government. And most of the people who'd been involved in the revolution, as many saw it at the time in Egypt, were jailed and executed. So these were, in a way, a kind of trick by the United States in order to spark a revolution and then to identify the competition with the established order.
What do you mean tricked by the US to start or spark a revolution? I'm not too sure I follow that. Can you explain that a little further?
What I'm saying is I think the Arab Springs were, and there is evidence that there was, although of course there's a genuine movement out there, that some of that was triggered deliberately by elements in the West who wanted to flush out the opposition in these countries. Look, Bahrain is a tiny place. It's basically was used for pearl diving, and it was the British Empire that created this nightmare we have now by creating... What they wanted was an independent state, a port. In the 1970s, as the British Empire was collapsing, 1971, you got around about 1.5 million population, half of which are migrant workers there. And in 1973, in 2 years, they had to suspend the constitution. This has been basically a set up by the British, an authoritarian puppet state, which is now doing pretty much exactly what the Western world wants. Okay. And that is proved with this normalization with Israel, which is an apartheid state. As Desmond Tutu in South Africa said before he died, bless him, he's pointed out that this Israeli state is more apartheid even than South Africa was, more racist against the Palestinians because it wants to wipe the Palestinians out. Now, how can any Arab country in its normal mind be normalized relations with Israel? It's impossible.
Well, you talked about a few different issues or topics there. Let me ask you about first the so-called normalization that Bahrain was so keen to do after the UAE. I mean, pretty much within a month, it came out and established ties. Well, I said reestablished, the slip of the tongue, because we know behind the scenes, Israel does have a relationship with these Persian Gulf Arab countries and their monarchies. One of the angles behind this normalization is said that Bahrain wanted to make sure that it's in U.S.'s, so to speak, good hands or a positive outlook from the White House on Bahrain in order to make sure that the U.S. somewhat overlooks the human rights violations that are taking place on the island. But here we are 2 years later. What did the Bahrain gain from this so-called normalization? What did it do for it?
So to speak about the base of the problem, in Bahrain there is a minority that rules the majority. What does this minority base on in order to be able to impose itself on the majority of the people? It is based solely on its alliances with strong countries, specifically USA and Britain, and now Israel. Israel is not as strong as before, but Bahrain would do anything for the USA just to stay. Al-Khalifa would do anything just to stay in power. They receive support from them, and not only their the silence on their crimes. Here I want to point out something that Sheikh Isa Qasim said today, the leader of the Bahraini opposition. He spoke about the Bahrainese authorities fight against religion. We, as human rights organization, we do monitor that. But he said their fight against religion is unjustified because the authorities does not need it to maintain their rule. He said that this fight against religion is an external condition for their staying in power. Yes, to this extent, the Bahraini authorities would obey the dictates of external allies. Because the basis of its very presence in power is based on its alliances with these countries. So, yes, it would normalize. It would do anything
when
just
when
that
you talk about religion from Sheikh Isa Qasim, are you talking about how he is saying that they are somewhat differentiating then between the Shias and the Sunnis? Because that's not that's not what really, for example, Iran doesn't look at it that way. Iran as a third party. On looking this whole situation. I'm just wondering what you mean by the religion aspect there.
No, he clearly said today that there is a fight against religion. It's not a fight against a sect or just slander, creating slander between sects in Bahrain. There is a fight against Islam, as he said. Uh-huh. And he said they don't need it. Actually, we do monitor that. They do. They broke mosques. And they daily in prisons, they deprive Muslim prisoners sometimes from praying. It happens a lot. Yes, so he said they don't need it. Why do they do it? And he says it is an external dictation just as a condition to stay in power. Yes, and we do see that clear. because we do monitor it.
What are they so afraid of by doing that, though? When you say that, obviously they feel like they can relinquish the importance that the majority have in terms of, for example, the Shias. And I'm not trying to turn this into a Shia or a Sunni thing. I'm just curious about that, because they are obviously afraid by making that type of or having that type of approach towards the rest of the Bahraini population, right?
Well, it happens that the majority are Shia, so they are afraid that the Shia would take over the rule. But you know what? From the beginning, the opposition, in all its sects and all its ideologies, political ideologies, some of them are not religious-based, they're only asking for, demanding for, I forgot the term in English, reforms and civil rights and welfare rights.
Right.
Today, despite all the crimes committed by the Bahraini authorities, and despite the presence of the political opposition leaders in prisons and abroad, and despite the presence of more than 2,000 prisoners of conscience in prisons, the popular opposition forces are still calling on the authority to dialogue. The Deputy Secretary General of the Al-Wifaq National Islamic Society called on dialogue just today. They still called for dialogue because they reflect their seriousness in the demands that they always called on.
Okay.
Let me direct
that angle of what you said to our guest Tony Gussling. A call for dialogue sounds simple enough. Why doesn't the U.S. make that call? Why doesn't the U.K. make a call for the ruling family to have dialogue with the opposition, which, well, they have disbanded, but, I mean, that sounds like a good idea, doesn't it?
Well, of course it does, but the godless West, although it sometimes talks about Christianity, of course it's just like the Knights Templar and the Crusades, it's got nothing to do with real Christianity. They look at what's been going on in Ukraine, too. There is no wish to dialogue. The idea is war, I'm afraid, because war makes a lot of money and war can grab resources. There's, by the way, really important to stress when you're talking about Bahrain, any of your viewers that want to look into what happened there, and it's a horrific story what the regime did in the Arab Spring. Your competition, Al Jazeera, did a documentary, Shouting in the Dark, I remember watching, which is absolutely shocking to see how a government can treat its people. A government is supposed to really be a servant of its people. This government is not. It is afraid of its people. It's when I talk about the godless West, this is just another puppet regime of the West, just like Zelensky in Ukraine. Puppets, these people, are not sovereign countries whatsoever. And they're puppets of an organisation called CENTCOM. CENTCOM dominates the Middle East, and it is a U.S. military office, part of the American military plans to dominate the world. They have these offices for all parts of the world. They're that arrogant. The EU and the UK are also part of this, you know, this coalition, which is attempting war. Now, the reason why is because they are having an international push right now for a world government, and they want that war to cause so much chaos that they can say, well, come on, we all need to get together and sort this out. But they want to dominate the outcome, and that's how crazy they are. They're okay. Not interested in a multipolar world with different countries having different cultures, different points of view. They're trying to force the issue by forcing a world war, and Bahrain is just one more puppet on that string.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, you have the US's Fifth Fleet that's stationed there. Rabbi, you have the UK that established a military base in the year 2018, which is said was to strengthen its presence in West Asia. Of course, when you have these two countries that are supposedly the flag bearers of democracy right under their nose, as you mentioned, 2,000 prisoners of conscience, torture, abuses, etc., puts into question why they are overlooking that. But is the bigger question right across that bridge by the name of Saudi Arabia, which is why the U.S. Wanted to prevent this revolution from progressing at the rate that it was, because it was right at the back door of Saudi Arabia, and it couldn't afford for the kingdom to pretty much have its population rise against it. Do you agree with that?
It could be. I don't have facts about that, but yes, it could be like that. Anyway, today the Bahrain people are given a second chance to their government, to the Al Khalifa dynasty. But it does. But there is no loom that the authorities will respond to the peaceful demands. But about the political reasons behind why the U.S. is doing that, or we really don't know. But we do know for a fact that the USA and Britain can simply order the Bahrain authorities not to repress its people, and the Bahrain authorities will be more than happy to comply, because it is the orders of its masters. They just don't, because they don't care about the Bahraini people, and because maybe, as you say, it is for their benefit that the Bahraini people are being repressed.
The way that the opposition has been crushed is really, in a sense, to use I can't use another word or think of another word right now, but farcical, Tony Gosling, when you take a look at the 2022 elections. I don't know if you recall, they held elections, but there were no opposition candidates. So they came out and they raved about the fact that there was such a turnout, you had so many people that came out, but they had banned the opposition candidates from this. I mean, that's whitewashing the whole thing. Basically, you had the two obviously main opposition groups who were banned from this. Again, it puts into question this notion of democracy that it seems like it's important for them to display to the world so people get an idea that there is maybe some notion of that, but clearly there's not.
Well, look, it's an insult to the intelligence of Bahrainis, and it's an insult to the intelligence of every human being on planet Earth. This is a sham democracy. It's basically a puppet show, a stage show, and the idea that we all believe everything that we see on the Western television. I'm afraid this is, as one of my colleagues, for the stupid people. The idea is that nobody actually understands what's really going on, except the people maybe in Bahrain itself. And this is, of course, it falls at the feet of the Western press. The Western press is dominated. I used to work for the BBC myself, and I can tell you, it's now become just a propaganda machine. The sort of thing when I was growing up, we were told went on in the Soviet Union. The idea that, you know, you've got a command economy and a one-party state. Effectively, you've got exactly the same in Bahrain, a one-party state, and democracy is a sham. But this will come to a head, and when the rubber hits the road, as they say, I'm quite certain that the Bahraini people will get what they want, but it may not be for a while yet, and there may well be much, much greater conflagration. Of course, the Middle East, the big focus for the West point of view, still is the oil supplies. And I wonder, and I think the case is that the reason the West is going very anti-oil is because they know there's going to be a war, and they know that war will threaten their supply of oil. So that's why they're going bananas right now about electric cars and things like that. They're trying to stop oil because they know a war is coming. And I don't like to be the harbinger of bad news, but as far as I can see, both in Central Europe and Eastern Europe and in the Middle East, the forces of darkness are really trying to push. And that's why they're not discussing, that's not why they're not debating. But I wonder whether many of these caliphates and the people who are running the Gulf states realize what's going on. I'd like to warn them. Watch out. Do not trust the USA. Do not trust your Western backers.
Sure. Well, and don't trust Israel. I think that's another thing that, again, Rabbi, we can discuss a little bit more. In my question to you, and there was somewhat shocking act that occurred between Israel and the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain, where Israel bought an island there. I think it was to the tune of $150 million, where you had the daughter of one of the activists come up with a tweet that said that's best described as colonial expansion from a ruling foreign ruling family that occupied Bahrain violently and has been ruling it violently. How dangerous is the Israeli factor in this, do you think?
The Bahraini authorities deal with Bahrain as if it's their property. I mentioned that earlier. This is definitely very much dangerous because they are selling land. They own, not just this island. They are selling other land in the mainland of Bahrain. It's all an island, a big island, but they are selling land. It's as if they're turning it to a second Palestine. In some protests, people actually held banners that said, we don't want to become a second Palestine, because they're turning it into like a Jew. They say it's Judaism project or something like that. As I agree totally with your other guest when he spoke about the Bahraini authorities should be aware of their future, because the USA has no future in being the solely pole in the world anymore. Today, the Bahraini authorities can still go back, can still go back in their steps, can still take their opportunity that is still given by the opposition, and I really don't see that they will do, but we can just hope. About the elections, I would like to say, please, I would like to comment.
Quickly.
This is the third consecutive election that happened this way. Opposition leaders who used to represent more than 60% of voters are now in prison and are not allowed to be elected anymore. That's how sham it is, and nobody cares in the whole world.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. Again, everybody, we appreciate it. Researcher, Bahrain Forum for Human Rights from Beirut, Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from Bristol. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikaba Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar.
Peace be upon you, O Aba Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet. We find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived a short period of his holy life in the city of Baghdad. While he was in the city of Baghdad, he tended towards knowledge and wisdom, and his eminence established the basis and the principles of knowledge, and he made use of the period of his stay in Baghdad in order to spread knowledge and wisdom and teach the different sciences and to merge the intellect with the Islamic sciences and literature. A great number of scholars and narrators joined Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam to learn from his eminence the different Islamic sciences such as theology, philosophy, jurisprudence, and the interpretation of the Quran, the tafsir.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed imam from the household of the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, he lived in an era which was contemporary with the Abbasid governmental establishment. Now, the Abbasid governmental establishment was, at this point in time, relatively well established. It could be said that they had reached their peak and now they were coming down towards their downfall. Of course, you know, in the historical context, you won't realize this or you won't really witness this in a very clear manner. But of course, any kind of historical analysis will show you, right, so that this is what was happening at the time of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Of course, it could be said that the peak of strength of the Abbasid governmental establishment was during Harun al-Rashid, and then it kind of plateaued towards the era of Ma'mun al-Rashid, and could be said that this was the peak. After that, we kind of see that the governmental establishment was beginning to break down. Now, during the era of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, because of the previous eras, and this is all a historical journey, which is very interesting when you follow. So during the Umayyad Caliphate, we find that there was this prevention of the collection of the Holy Quran. There was the prevention of the writing down of the traditions of the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And there was this misinformation and misguidance which was being conducted, of course, along with moral corruption and moral degradation and a whole bunch of other bad things that were happening during the Umayyad governmental establishment. And then we kind of see this influx of different theological, philosophical, and jurisprudential schools of thought, especially during the Abbasid